Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
Irish writer Colm Tobin is a master. Whether it's his novels like Brooklyn or Nora Webster, maybe The Testament of Mary, he's got a settled style of writing that brings you not just to a place or an event, but to specific moments, and those moments always add up to something special. It's the same for his short stories. He's got a new compilation out now. It's called News from Dublin. I'm thrilled to have him on this edition of Steve Bertrand on Books. I started by asking him the difference between writing those novels and a short story, and he says the story ideas, whether long or short, come from a kernel or maybe one of those moments.
A novel begins the same way, which is that you have an idea, or you have a character, or you have a configuration, or you have a scene, and you wait until that moves into rhythm. In other words, that you get a sentence rather than an idea. From an idea, you get a sentence, you get a paragraph, you get a sound. And I think it works the same way for both. The difference with the novel is that you have to start working on it. With the story, you can leave it there. Other stories are going to come. You might not be ready to do it. But a novel is almost an emergency, where once it starts, you really have to sit down to work on it. And if you don't work on it, you could lose it. In other words, the whole urgency of the feeling of getting it down and getting it written. And even though it can take, you know, it can take time, it can take a year, 2 years, 3 years, you have to treat it all the time as an emergency. If you say, oh, I have so much time to work on this, it's fine, I needn't do anything today or tomorrow or the next day. And also there's a problem with the novel, which is halfway through a novel, you feel, I know the rest of this story. Do I really need to go on? Is there any way I could just stop now and start another novel? And the answer is no. The answer is just no. But a short story is closer to a poem in that you could look back at notebooks and think, there's a single line I could work from now. And so it's like they're like each other in that you have to finish them. You know, the starting comes on its own, but finishing doesn't.
Well, it sounds like a short story cooks more than a novel cooks.
Yeah, that I suppose you... Also, a story really does depend on a sort of turn, a moment where something does or doesn't happen that seems to have a shimmering or shivering sort of reality to it. And you don't know when that's going to come, and you don't know how you're going to manage it. If you manufacture it, it seems manufactured. But if you don't have it, the story is dead. That doesn't happen with a novel. A novel's internal rhythm is very, very different.
I enjoyed immensely the short story collection that's out now, The News from Dublin. And I want to ask you, I don't think maybe short story doesn't... What I'm trying to say is I've been struggling with this in my mind, because reading your short stories, they're almost like contemplations more than they are activities. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, yes, I suppose it does. What I'm trying to do is have nothing much happen. But in the nothing much happening, you're getting an illustration or some sort of contemplation, yes, of character, of a certain moment in someone's life where things didn't exactly change, but something became clear. Mm-hmm. A second where something becomes clear. And it may just be a moment that becomes immensely memorable. It might just be as simple as that, but obviously it doesn't require plot, and it doesn't really require any great idea of transformation, of the character changing. So you're really working with areas of subtlety, which is very close to that of a poem.
You leave work for your reader to do in your short stories.
Yes, I suppose that there's a short story called A Sum of Money, and it's pretty clear that the son has been stealing in his boarding school, and he's been expelled for that. Now, what I have to do is I have to get him home. What's going to happen when they close the door of that house? And he's with his parents, he's an only child, and there he is, he's 16, 17 years old. What is going to happen now between these three people? And my thing is, nothing much. They're too embarrassed. They're almost not going to talk about it. And then they're not talking about it. It seems the agenda for the rest of their lives has somehow been set. But more important, what happens on the journey from the school to home, where they're being driven by a priest? So the priest is driving, the father's in the front seat, the kid is in the back. What am I going to have them do on the way, on that journey? And the answer is the priest is smoking. He's a tremendous smoker. It's the old days. People are smoking. The father is a smoker, and they talk about brands of cigarettes. They go through all the old brands of cigarettes. And the kid is in the back, obviously not smoking, listening to this conversation, realizing somehow or other it's almost directed at him. They're talking about this elaborate system of things in order to exclude him. And obviously all the smoke is coming back in the small car. It may be that the big drama has occurred before, has occurred in the car, as they talk about the cigarettes. And in a way, you know, you're working, you suddenly think, what? I need to give the priest a characteristic. I could give him a physical tick or some sort of verbal tick, something that distinguishes him. But what if he's one of those old-fashioned Irish smokers who just loved a cigarette and smoked what are called chain smokers? And what if he was that? And then that would give me then into the whole just remembering all the names of all the cigarettes that in my parents' time that different people would have. And it would in some way distinguish their personality, whether you smoked Rothmans or Craven A, what sort of person you were. There were cigarettes that are really Benson and Hedges that only women smoked. And then there were 20 major men smoked. But this is from pure memory. I did no research. I did not Google anything. I simply remembered.
I've traveled to Ireland quite a lot. We have Irish family, and it sounds like a typical Irish conversation where the words spoken are not what the conversation is about.
Yeah, that, and if you can work with that, you can get a sour poetry from it, where the names of the cigarettes almost become a sort of mantra.
Yeah. While we've got the collar on, I want to talk about A Free Man, which is the story of a pedophile. After he's out of prison, and there's sort of, it's difficult to talk about short stories because I don't want to give away the ending, and there's so many endings in this book, right? But there's a sort of shocking revelation that this man makes that I'm wondering is difficult or was difficult for you to write.
I was so engaged with the whole business of giving him all the work about finding somewhere to live in Barcelona. You know, he's in prison in Ireland. He's a well-known criminal. I mean, people know his face. There's been a big controversy about his pension. Headlines called the pedo and his pension. And so I'm so involved in this business of his day to day, how he gets a bank account, how he bills, how he gets an apartment, all those things. That the other business, there are two things. One, I am not going to go into the details of what he did. For the main reason is because he doesn't. In his mind, he has blanked that. He's almost living as though this hasn't happened. And so he hasn't ruined the lives of all these young people. He's living outside his own guilt. The reader is aware of it, of course, because the reader can see there's a certain moment where, you know, his lawyers are, you know, just don't want anything to do with him. He's a reviled figure. But of course, in his own mind, he isn't. And in his own mind, he's blanked that. Then the question is what he's doing in prison, because of course the probation officers and the psychiatrists, you know, there's a great deal of so-called treatment, and they force him to admit this is what not only what I did, but this is who I am. I am the person who did this, and this seems reasonable until a certain moment, in which is I suppose this very central drama of the story, which I wasn't expecting. But his friend in Barcelona, who runs a bar, who's sort of jokey figure, sort of trickster figure, just wants to talk a lot about what the prison was like, were there any Jesuits in the prison, for example, you know, what sort of Christian brothers were in the prison. He wants to know what the minutiae of the prison. He's sort of creepy about this. Suddenly says to him, do you feel sorry? And for a second, he loses it. For a second, he gives himself away. He says, I was sorry I was caught. Yeah. He just says it. I was sorry I was caught. And the minute he says it, he realizes he shouldn't have said it. And the reader realizes, actually, this is him. This is the only time in the story we're going to get him actually in some way or other confronting what's happened or dealing with what's happened. And that came to me as I worked. I saw it there and I realized that is the only thing that makes any sense. He needs for once to say it. And the reader has to feel, wow, all this stuff about him getting the apartment, all this stuff about is a whole mask for a sort of guilt that he doesn't feel. And whereas one presumed that he felt so much guilt he couldn't face it. But it's almost the opposite. He sort of left all that out. And when I had it written, and I mean, obviously I do a lot of work on the stories, just about cutting them back and adding, you know, just a lot of small sentence by sentence work. I thought this story depends on four words. Five words.
He's not a priest. He studied the priesthood, but he left. He was in prison with many priests. That must have been a calculation that you made to not make him a priest.
I just thought that would be too easy. And it didn't ever really occur to me to do that. I thought the whole business of him having been in the priesthood, it was slightly more dramatic, the idea that he was a maths teacher. And so that he wasn't being, so in other words, he his power was, of course, that so many kids, anyone who's ever been bad at maths knows, what you desperately need is a good maths teacher. Like, a good maths teacher is gold. You know, a priest can come to the house and he's a real outsider, you know, but if a maths teacher came to teach you maths into your own house, he would have an awful lot of power. And he would seem to be helping you enormously if you were a kid. And the parents would love him coming, and everyone would enjoy his company, the maths teacher. And so there was another way into the idea that this man had a funny sort of power, or a funny sort of way of getting into a house. And also, a great number of men left the priesthood in Ireland. You know, the number of people who went into that seminary. And a lot of, you know, I would, large numbers left. And so that was another thing I wanted to explore, just the idea that, I mean, it wouldn't be the case now. People of my generation, very few would have gone in. But if you're going back 20 years, a good numbers would have gone in.
I think that's interesting that the maths teacher is more intimately related to the family than the priest. I don't know that
a lot of us would consider that. That's absolutely the case. Yeah. I mean, in suburban Dublin in those years, a priest visiting the house would be unusual.
Yeah.
You know, the Dublin suburban parishes were very big, and priests wouldn't do that necessarily. But if you could get a good maths teacher for your...
I was reading a review of the book in the Financial Times. John Self wrote it, and he said, short stories reveal an author's recurring obsessions, and with you, it's family. Reading the book or reading what you read, that seems fair. Do you think that's fair? And if so, what is it about your family that it reveals?
Yeah, I mean, the problem for me is that I may have recurring obsessions, but if you started to work from that idea, oh, I have a recurring obsession, here's another story from that obsession of mine. In other words, each time I start as though this character is singular, doesn't come from any obsession that I've expressed before, that everything is individual. So in other words, there's a story about a young man living in San Francisco. He's living illegally there, and it's almost as though he's in between two families, neither of which he's fully part of. I suppose that's what I'm more interested in, is when that carapace, when the structure of family falls apart, what do we have then? And we have drama. In other words, that there's something elemental about those relationships between siblings and between parents and children. If you break that, as you do, say, in that story, Five Bridges, where he's in San Francisco, he has a daughter by a woman he never married. He's seeing the daughter sometimes. So he's that's a part-time relationship almost. And he's been away from home for 30 years, but he's going back home. And so he's in between, in the same way as the boy with the sum of money, I suppose, in between being the family of the boarding school and the family he's going back to. But the problem is, if I start thinking too much about this as part of some larger vision, then I lose it. But I wonder if large numbers of novels and stories are set in that arena of marriages, parents and children, siblings, love affairs that are almost families.
Well, it's also something we all share, too, I think, that can help us. But the novelist Kazuo Ishiguro told me one time that he doesn't even like to do book signings or author talks because he doesn't want the audience to tell him sometimes what he's writing, right? Because he's not consciously aware of some of the themes. And if they're pointed out to him, then they'll lose some of their genuineness. I think that's what you're saying.
I wish he'd put a big ad up about that early on so I could have learned it and known it. I'd never heard that before. It's an absolutely brilliant idea that, you know, that the less you know, the better you're going to be, the more you're working from unconscious obsessions, the more likely you are to make the story singular, as though this is really a single story you are telling that you've never told before. And I was in Australia once and a woman said to me, how many people die in this book?
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. And what'd you tell her?
A lot.
Let's go back to Five Bridges, because the story about that story is the nonfiction is almost as good as the fiction here. I mean, it was a prophetic story. You wrote this book. In fact, you wrote particular passages on the day or right around when President Trump was inaugurated. You didn't mention earlier that this man going back after 30 years is here illegally. So tell me about how that story came about and why you wrote it when you wrote it.
Yeah, I had done a walk in about 2006 in Muir Woods, which is outside San Francisco. And I had done it with three friends. And often when I do something like that, it's like being a child almost. I go into a dream of a character who's doing the same walk, who obviously isn't me, but nonetheless is doing what I'm doing. And so I did have stuff in a notebook about the walk and about how the walk was arranged, because it was a strange thing that when you get to the top, you're allowed to make your own dinner. You know, you get use of the kitchen for a particular period as part of your deal. And so you bring up your own food and a backpack, and it's not a restaurant, but it is a kitchen, and it's a lovely idea. And everyone gets their turn, and everybody cleans up after themselves. And so I just thought that was an interesting thing for these four people to do, especially if one of them was about to leave America and never come back, like a Moore's Last Sigh. You're seeing this beautiful Pacific Ocean, the moon at night, the sun, and the beautiful trees. And so I just had that in my head. I had that trip described, not as a diary, but as for the character. And then, so that it was really in the book for 15, it was in the notebook for 15 years. And Trump was going to be elected a second time. And it struck me from his rhetoric that he was really going to further demonize migrants. And these were going to become the sort of hate figures of his second administration. And he was going to sort of do more, meaning ICE was going to be unleashed further. And I realized if I was this guy, 30 years illegal in America, with roots set down, but nonetheless only an Irish passport. He came in on a tourist visa 30 years earlier. He's making his living, he's paying his taxes, he's doing, you know, he's got a place to live. He's got a daughter. Mm-hmm. But I would think of going. I would think, I'm not going to leave myself vulnerable to being picked up on the street. I'm going home. But if you leave, it's a strange one. It's like something in a folk tale. You never get back into America. The minute you would present yourself again, your name would come up. So it's a final thing. And if you've got a 12-year or 10-year-old daughter, it's a very big wrench. But it's a choice between the wrench or being vulnerable to ICE. And so as Trump's inauguration approached, which I think was around the 20th of January, I realized that I was going to get him out of America on the day of the inauguration itself, which meant that the walk he would take with his daughter, the one that I took all the years before, up into Muir Woods and spend the night up there, that was going to happen on the Saturday before Trump's inauguration. I made that day very special. I got up early. I had nothing social to do that day. And I worked all that day on describing further the walk up with the daughter, the fact that he was leaving. So a good lot of the story had been written, but a good lot of it then, the rest of it, was done on the actual day it is taking place. So in other words, I'm writing it for that Saturday. I'm writing it on that Saturday. I'm writing it about that Saturday. So there's an element of sort of superstition involved. But basically, I got Paul out of America before Trump's inauguration. And I published the story in The New Yorker a few weeks later. So it was the only time I've done that where I've usually it takes me years, where I operate according to a sort of a funny deadline set by an event itself.
And then a few months later, there was a man named Seamus Culleton, who I think maybe was in Philadelphia, I'm not sure, an Irish illegal who was taken by ICE, correct?
Yeah. In other words, it seemed at first as though they were going to pick on people from Central America. But then there was the case of this Irish guy, Seamus Culleton, and he came in on exactly the same visa. And you can say he was illegal in America, but he was legal in about 10 ways and illegal in one. You
know? Right, yes.
You know, if you're taking taxes from somebody over a period of 20 years, you want to be careful about calling them illegal. Maybe their paying taxes was illegal, given their taxes package are so illegal.
That's a very fair point. I'm glad you brought it up. I did a news series years ago on immigrants working in Chicago. And, you know, at the time, the number one population of undocumented people were Irish, right? And we were proud of that, and we were proud of the work they did. And there was a restaurant owner who would bring people in. And you're right about that. I mean, and maybe 19 out of 20, more than 10 out of 11.
Yeah.
We benefited from them. And what's happened, you know, I'm again in Chicago, where the ICE focus for some time. So it's been a terrible thing. While we're talking about going back, leaving the U.S. for Ireland, you write in Sleep a sentence that I want to hear more from you about. It says, there's always a sense of being released when a plane takes off from JFK for Dublin. What does that mean?
I mean that there's a pressure on you if you're an outsider, if you're Irish, say, and you're in New York. You're always, every time you speak, somebody's going to be able to ask you a question like, are you British or where are you from? Or there's a constant pressure on you that you don't even realize is there. And you're in another country, you're in another culture. You might get used to it slowly, but it's not where you're from. And you don't think about this. It doesn't bother you. But there is a moment, everyone in Ireland recognizes it, that you arrive, say, in JFK, or it could be O'Hare. It could be in Boston, and you moving towards the terminal and then the gate where the Irish are gathering in order to get the plane home. And you start seeing Irish people. And you should say, be able to say, hold on, there's nothing Irish. I mean, it's not as though you could say, you know, but actually there is. There's something in the way people look, a sort of, if you're a man, a sort of lack of arrogance, but a sort of, there could be a stubbornness at the same time, a lack of ease in public spaces, a couple pushing a trolley along with too much luggage could look very uneasy in a very Irish way, in that they're never quite sure that they should be even here at all. Someone's going to stop them, and they're not quite sure how they're going to handle this. And the, you know, at, you look at this, and then you hear the soft voices, people just talking in this much softer way. And even just somebody could just say, how are you, to you? How are you? How are you? Just, I mean, it's a funny idea. How are you? You'd be passing by, someone could look and say, how are you? 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 And you could get on the plane, and the cabin crew on Aer Lingus, the Irish national carrier, are mainly Irish. And of course, they're the same age as maybe your sister or your niece or something. And they're saying, are you all right? Would you like more tea? And just someone saying to you, honestly, someone saying to you, would you like more tea? you could tear up. You know, I know on planes you're much more likely to get really emotional. I don't know why this should be. It must be the thinness of the air or something. But the air hostess just saying to you, would you like more tea? And it has everything going back on since you were five, of some mother or aunt or sister, some woman just with a pot of tea. I mean, I know this is a sort of cliche about, you know, women's role, but I'm just sure. Remembering. Would you like more tea?
Maybe another phrase would be the first time you hear someone say "your man," then you know
your man.
Home.
Yeah, your man over there. Look at your man.
It's taken me decades, Colm. I still can't use it correctly. I don't understand it. Okay, Summer of 38 is another one of these stories where the nonfiction behind the fiction is pretty dramatic. Where this is Spain during what, the Civil War, I guess, pre-Franco or during Franco's siege. Tell me about how you came upon this story.
There's a historian in the Pyrenees called Manuel Jimeno, and because one part of the Pyrenees is the Catalan Pyrenees, is sort of remote and sparsely populated, he could manage to do a book describing each death, charting it from original sources, from written sources and from oral sources. And I went to see him just to talk about his methodology. And Catalonia was anti-Franco, and it prides itself on this. And the higher you go up into the Pyrenees, the more fierce people are about that I suppose, that their history of being anti-Franco. And so he described inviting a general, a fascist general from Madrid, who had fought in the Civil War 50 years earlier, to come to the village in the Pyrenees to describe to show him exactly where certain things had occurred. The general came, and as we're walking through this village, a woman in her 70s, like the general, out shopping, saw the general, he saw her, and they both recognized each other. Hey, hey, look at you. Hey, hey, como va todo? Hey, que. And the general was a bit surprised my historian was a bit surprised because really, you know, it isn't actually what you would expect, that level of friendliness and sort of intimacy. And then in his research, realized that that village, a place called Pobla de Segur, actually was quiet for that summer of 38. When the Civil War was raging all around and the troops were stationed there, had parties at night down by the river. And they were Southerners and they had brought the guitars and they liked drinking wine and they liked singing. And so some girls would go down to those parties. Afterwards, of course, no one wanted to talk about that.
Sure.
And the minute he told me that story, I wanted to stop him and say, please stop talking, because I have a story from that. That's a story. And so I wrote Summer of 38.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. Does it have any application to the U.S. today? Here you go.
But it has application for, it's the idea of getting older. And recently at home in Ireland, I was doing a reading near where I'm from, and two people came, and I really hadn't seen either of them since 1972. Now, if you add that up, that's 54 years, I think. Yeah, it's 54 years. They hadn't changed physically. Obviously, they've got 54 years older. But, you know, when you're younger, you think, oh, surely, how could old people recognize each other? But I recognized them immediately. Hi, and I knew their names and I knew everything. And that idea that he sees her after all the years, or that, you know, that her memory of him is absolutely clear, in the same way as some of us have memories of things that happened when we were 20 or 23 or 24 that are vivid in our minds, so that if we saw the person again, we would absolutely not only recognize them, but a sort of flood of emotion would come surrounding what had happened. And, I think it's applicable anywhere.
The recognition is just part of the story. Obviously, it's what the woman in this story does with the recognition.
I have to work with the idea, are we going to have that recognition scene? What if we didn't have it? Yeah. And so you're always trying to say, you wake up every morning thinking, is the obvious way of telling this story, for example, that in a sum of money, because he was caught stealing, the parents are going to shout at him. What if they don't?
Are you active on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook.
Do you post yourself? Do you do your own posts? You do. I'm going to tell you a story that you're not going to remember. But we met maybe 12 or 14 years ago. You were coming through Chicago. Facebook was relatively new, and I was doing these author interviews, and I was trying to get an audience. And so I asked you at the end of the interview, I said, listen, Cullum, would you please post this on Facebook for me, because it would really help me? And you turn to me and say, I don't really do that stuff, but I'll give you my password and you can post it yourself.
Really?
Yeah, you did. You gave me your password. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I wouldn't do that. But I would tell you the password now. But I don't know if you're using the same one, but yeah, it's a wonderful memory of mine.
I have a problem always with technology. You know, every single thing is done step by step. Even I never went to a course, like a lot of people, I think, in how to use a laptop or what things to press to get what. I learned everything on the hoof and slowly. But there was one afternoon in San Francisco where I must have been waiting for a flight or something. And someone with me just said, "Why don't I just put you on Facebook?" And if he hadn't said that, I would never have gone on Facebook. Because I tried to go on Instagram, but I don't know how to take a photograph on a phone and then move that photograph onto Instagram. I've tried to learn that, but I don't know how to do it. Soon I will learn that. But
well, it's millions do it.
What's that?
I said millions know how to do it, so I think it's within your realm. I so enjoy talking to you, and I enjoy reading what you write. There's such a tone or a mood or it's like getting on the jet to Ireland, because when you start to read a Colm Tóibín book, there's a gentleness to it.
Thank you very much. That's a good thing to say. That reading the book is like getting on an Aer Lingus flight back to Dublin.
Yeah. All right. So if I send you this interview, will you post it on Facebook?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Totally.
If not, I'll do it myself, because I know what your password
is. I'm
just teasing you. Listen, it was wonderful. Okay. Wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Okay. Take care. Okay. Bye.
The great Colm Tóibín. His latest is The News from Dublin. Next week, we'll stay with the Irish writers and talk with Tana French. Her latest is The Keeper. It's the third of her books in the Cal Hooper series. Hooper's a great character. He's a retired Chicago police detective who settles into small-town Ireland. And, he's a blow-in, according to the Irish. And he's got to figure out their ways and try to adapt to them and fit right in. It's not always easy. In fact, it's usually pretty tough. And Tana throws in a crime or two along the way as well. Tana French next week. Listen, I'm glad you listened to Steve Bertrand on Books this week, and I'd love to hear from you. My email is stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. It'd be great if you subscribe to the podcast as well. You can do that at Spotify or at that the podcast icon on your iPhone or wherever you get your podcast. We should be available. For now, I'm Steve Bertrand saying thanks very much for listening. Keep turning those pages.